Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Corgus Productions concludes its season with the British Columbia-based dance troupe Kid Pivot tonight at the Helmerich Theatre at Casha Hall in an imaginative retelling of Shakespeare's The Tempest titled The Tempest Replica. Kid Pivot features the choreography of their founder, internationally known choreographer Crystal Pite, who's created over 40 works for companies like Netherlands Dance Theatre, the National Ballet of Canada, where she was an associate choreographer, as well as Ballet Frankfurt and Le Ballet Jazz de Montreal, where she was the resident choreographer. She's recently named an associate artist at Sadler Wells in London. In 2002, she formed her own company, Kid Pivot, based in Vancouver, which integrates movement, original music, text, and rich visual design, as well as intense theatricality. Kid Pivot's performances display Pite's choreographic language, a movement that fuses classical elements with the complexity and freedom of structured improvisation. That's certainly on display in The Tempest Replica, which presents Shakespeare's play in two parallel worlds. The first is presented as an onstage storyboard, with the plot points of the narrative delivered minimally through chalk-white replicas. Eventually, they're fleshed out by real characters as the themes of Shakespeare's The Tempest are displayed, a magician bent on revenge, ultimately deciding to choose virtue over vengeance, relinquishing his power and ambition in order to find his humanity. Kid Pivot presents The Tempest Replica tonight at 8 at the Helmerich Theatre at the Casha Hall Performing Arts Center. And Crystal Pite joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Crystal Pite, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's nice to be here.
And it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. I really enjoy the way you choreograph movement. It is this wonderful blend of ballet and yet this sort of earthy contemporary, what we expect to see in contemporary dance. And it's this wonderful melding in which your movement just seamlessly moves between the two, those sort of two ideals, I guess, if you would. Give us a sense of how you came up with your choreographic style.
Well, I think my choreographic style is still evolving. I don't think I really set out to create a particular look or a style. It's really just been this slow process of gathering more information and more skill and being really influenced by the people that I work with. But you were mentioning ballet, and I have to say that ballet is kind of how I started. I mean, I did lots of other things, but ballet was always my default. Growing up, training, and then I danced in a couple of contemporary ballet companies, as a company dancer. So ballet is really in my system. It's wired right into my hard drive. You know, it's really a part of how I move, and even in the moments where I really want to completely shed any of those references, it can be really tough to do that. So yeah, it's in the mix. But then there are a lot of dance forms that are in the mix. And just current contemporary styles. I'm very influenced by the people that are in front of me. So if they've been working with other choreographers, that language also lives inside their bodies and is accessible to us all.
I was kind of chuckling as you were talking because, it's true. There's a great deal of ballet in there, but your dancers spend a lot of time on the ground, too.
Right. They do spend a lot of time on the ground.
Rolling.
And that's a really good distinction because that's one of the great, I guess, shifts of territory. When you move from classical ballet to contemporary movement, you just get closer and closer and closer to the floor until you're using the floor like a kind of partner, like a kind of dance partner. And then great contemporary movers can go seamlessly from using the floor as a kind of partner or as a surface or a landscape to dance on and then going back to the vertical, so, and everything in between. So it's a good observation.
One of the things I love about the work is your dancers seem just on the verge of being off balance in many ways. I mean, it's very beautiful the way it looks, but there's almost like a bit of gravity defiance in some of the dance, yeah. The way you have them move, and especially the arm and upper body movement that's a part of what seems to be your style. It's quite wonderful to watch, but at the same time you're saying, wow, they look like they're just on the verge of losing balance.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that because it is something that we're really aspiring to. It's something that we really strive for in our work. And I say our work because it's myself, but it's all my dancers that are trying to help me to achieve that. It's something that we're all working towards. It's that sense of being on the edge, that sense of being destabilized, sense of being suspended, but also the sense of being moved, of not necessarily being in control, of being danced as opposed to dancing. So if you imagine how a puppet might be off kilter or be suspended at odd angles against gravity, it's the kind of thing we're trying to work towards in our movement. And the dancers I work with are particularly good at achieving that sense of risk, and I'm attracted to dancers that are willing to go there. So it's not a comfortable place, it's not an easy place. Being destabilized like that requires a lot of effort, a lot of conflict in the body in order to achieve it. So, like I said, I'm really drawn to people who are willing to go there.
There's a wonderful pas de deux in the Tempest replica between Ariel and Prospero, in which they're dancing literally cheek to jowl. They're literally using each other for their balance without their arms, but with their body themselves. You were talking about your dancers taking on that risk. I would think they would be at great risk. One misstep and all of a sudden you're not relying on your partner. You're flat on the floor.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And we achieve those things over time. That moment you're talking about is a good example. So when we first choreographed it, it may have been at a certain angle. But as they got more and more comfortable and more practiced at it, that angle became more and more and more extreme. And then through practice, you also learn the ways out of things. You learn the solutions to whatever problems come up. And there are inevitably misfires, you know, or misconnections. And it is part of our training. Part of what we're working on is also learning how to save ourselves when things do go sideways.
Well, the other thing that's really interesting is there's a number of lifts in that dance. And, you know, when we expect to see lifts, we expect to see the arms being used. But you're lifting without the arms. It's the crook of the elbow or the shoulders doing the lift or the chest itself.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And sometimes we might build a lift sequence using the hands, you know, just because we're getting used to it. And, for example, Eric might be hanging onto Sandra's shoulder and the inside of her knee. But then as they get better and better at it, we might move that grip so that he's actually partnering her with his wrists instead of his hands, or like you said, his elbows instead of his hands, because then you get the sense that she's flying at him, that he's not necessarily manipulating her, that she, as the muse, as the spirit, she's flying around his head, around his shoulders, you know, she's up and over him effortlessly of her own power. And so to release his hands off her body and to show his hands open, his fingers are alive, they're in a state of surprise or of delight or whatever it might be. But, you know, the hands really express a lot of emotion. And if I can get those hands to be available to get at the narrative in that moment rather than doing the actual mechanical partnering, then all the better.
It's interesting you said you're trying to show they don't control, because when I think of Prospero, I think of him as sort of the magician that's sort of pulling all the strings in the Tempest. And there's a number of scenes that sort of allude to that in this piece, Arthur.
You're absolutely right. And you're right, and particularly actually with his relationship with Ariel. He is trying to control her and to hang on to her and to stop her from leaving and to get her to do a lot of magic for him. But I think there's also this joy in their relationship, and that was something that I was interested in with this play, was Prospero's relationship to the muse and his amazement and his love for her. And so there's a lot of play there, as well as a lot of controlled manipulation.
So what interests you in doing a piece based on the Tempest? And what was the inspiration for doing the Tempest replica?
It's actually kind of a funny story, because I had set out for myself the challenge of working with an existing script for this production. I've worked with narrative in varying ways over the years, but I've never actually done a story, you know, with a beginning and a middle and an end. Like, I've never really done a true narrative piece. And so I wanted to work with an existing script, and I was searching and searching and searching, and I was looking for a long time in a more film noir genre kind of. I was thinking that I needed something with a lot of plot points, like a lot of action. But I wasn't connecting to any of those stories. I found them hollow. I was looking for something with more humanity. And then I was procrastinating, and I was reading a book about theater making by Peter Brook called The Open Door. And in that book, there's a chapter on creative process. And he uses his own 1960-something, I can't remember what year it was, production of The Tempest as a way to illustrate some points about how he works with his company and how he creates his work. So he was talking about The Tempest, and he was talking about the shipwreck. And you know, every director that works with The Tempest has to make a decision about that shipwreck because it's the only scene in the play that doesn't happen on the island.
Right.
So you have to think about, in practical terms, how much of your budget do you want to spend on that shipwreck scene? How much time can you afford to spend on all those sorts of things? And I got as far as the word shipwreck and I was caught. I just thought, shipwreck.
That's action.
That's it. That's what I want to put on stage. And I wanted to choreograph a shipwreck. I wanted to put a shipwreck inside a body and see if I could make a dance. I wanted to just work on theatrical magic to make a shipwreck come to life on stage. And I really connected to that idea. I got very, it was the original impulse for the production. And then I read the play, and I decided I couldn't do it as a dance. It was too complex of a story. There's all this crazy exposition, all these backstories. But eventually I returned to the play because I was really caught by the shipwreck, of course, but also by the higher themes of the play, which were really, really beautiful. I was drawn to the character of Prospero and the conflict within him about his art, about his magic, about his power, and having to relinquish that along with his desire for revenge in order to love, in order to forgive, and in order to do the right thing by his family, by his daughter.
And of course, you have the Shakespeare. You have the Shakespeare subtext as well. That this is Shakespeare
indeed
saying goodbye to the theater. I mean, in the same way that Prospero's saying goodbye to his magic.
Exactly, and of course, I connected with that as well. And this idea too of Prospero putting on a show. I think anybody that directs The Tempest is identifying with Prospero. He's the maker of the show. He's putting on a spectacle in order to deal with events in his life and to manifest change. And he's also dealing with Ariel, the muse, and Caliban, the monster. And I think that that's a duality in most creators that resonates. And I think, too, another reason I was so drawn to this play was the story of Prospero giving up his magic, giving up his art, giving up his power, drowning his book and breaking his staff in order to release his need for revenge, in order to forgive, in order to connect with his daughter, in order to love and return to his humanity. And for me, at the time I was making the show, I was a new mother. My son was about 8 months old. And I was really confronted with this question of ambition, power, art, magic, you know, versus family, and having to make sacrifices, having to let go, having to drown my book, so to speak, in order to be with my son. And I think that this is another reason why I was so caught by this story. And I've noticed, you know, over the years, especially with the context of my own company, whatever subject, whatever content it is that I choose to work with, we live with this story or this content for a long time. There's the research, there's the creation of the show, there's the rehearsals, there's the remount, there's the tours. The story can be in our lives for many years, and I need to be careful about what we choose. And so this The Tempest was something I felt like I could commit to for a really long time, and that it would inspire me and that it would challenge me.
And in fact, you're into your third year with this piece, with
right,
the company.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, the process of how you chose this particular story and the way you narrowed down the focus, because as you rightly said earlier, that there are a number of subplots that are going on, and really you broke it down to Prospero getting his revenge by making it right by his daughter. I mean, that's literally the story you're telling, it seems like.
Well, I think it's about him releasing his idea of revenge. Like, he decides not to take revenge on his brother and on the king and on the king's brother. He decides to let it go, to release them, to forgive, so that he can love, so that he can find his humanity. And I think that is this beautiful human story at the heart of that play.
And the way you depict this from the shipwreck and the story is very imaginative. I know you've used puppets in previous works. In this case, you have some almost, they're dancers, but they're lifelike puppets at the beginning of the show. You have this wonderful moment at the very beginning when you set it up with the paper boats, which, again, is just wonderfully theatrical.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, when I did decide to work with this play, I had to figure out a way to get this very complex story out to the audience. I mean, not most people that come to see this show don't have The Tempest in their back pocket the way they would another play of Shakespeare's, like Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet. You know, most people don't have The Tempest, I think, as available to them in their minds. So I felt like I did a really, really careful job with the storytelling. And as you said, I did reduce it and minimize. I took out the Gonzalo, the Stefano, the Trinculo. I reduced it to certain relationships that I felt I could lean on to tell the story and get to the heart of these relationships I wanted to choreograph. So I tell the story in about the first 30 minutes of the performance. We tell the story and we do it in a very stylized, very minimal, efficient way. And with those puppet figures, like you were describing, or mannequins, we call them replicas actually, and that's why the show is called Tempest Replica. These replicas are like models or stand-ins for the actual characters, and they aesthetically they look a little bit like those white plastic people you might find in an architectural model. They're there to show scale and mm-hmm. how the space might be used. And I tried to create a kind of on-stage storyboard. So you're watching the essential plot points of the narrative delivered in a kind of series of frames. The movement is also very minimal and efficient. They are using gesture and posture and just angles of heads and hands to really try to get the story out.
And you're using shadow techniques. You're also
right.
using projection to help tell the story and really efficiently tell the story.
That was the hope, yeah. I was hoping that it would be efficient, that it would be clear, and that we wouldn't leave anybody behind. But it does happen all very quickly. And I think that the shadow play is interesting because it adds another layer to the storytelling. But also creates, I mean, the surface of that backdrop becomes almost permeable. There's like you feel that there's a world on the other side of that, and Prospero's in conversation with that world, whether it's as memory or whether it's as ghost or as monster, shadow. It's always there as a kind of presence, and I really like that shadow world mm-hmm. in addition to the replica world.
So we're introduced to these characters as replicas, but 20, 30 minutes into the piece, they shed their replica and they become flesh and blood characters
in modern
dress. Since I haven't seen the whole piece, I've only seen bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. It looks like you're using pantomime, a bit of pantomime.
I think so. I don't know if I know enough about pantomime to be able to really answer that question accurately.
I mean, it's not pantomime the way it's done in classical ballet, but there's a bit of pantomime, and what I was really interested in is the way you use pantomime, and boom, you're into dance, and it's inter,
yeah.
I think of pantomime scenes in ballet, there's a pantomime scene, and then there's dance.
Uh-huh.
This is pantomime and dance put together to really do a wonderful job of, again, trying to concisely tell a difficult story to tell, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was hoping that by delivering the story the way we do, that two things would happen. One was that I could get to part two, as you say, the real world, these real flesh and blood characters. I could get there, and the audience will now know the story. They'll have the story fresh in their minds. And so when they're watching a duet now between Prospero and a young woman, they're understanding, okay, this is Miranda, this is his daughter. She's suffering, she's worried about the shipwreck, or she's in love with Ferdinand, and, you know, there's a whole relationship, there's a backstory there. And so when you're watching the dancing between these two people, it's imbued with meaning, and you're more invested. And I would say, you know, the reason I did that whole storyboarding replica thing at the top of the show was I was trying to earn the opportunity to choreograph those relationships.
Mm.
This complex, beautiful relationship between Prospero and the other characters. And without having to stop, by the time we get there, I don't want to stop along the way to really explain what's going on. I want the audience to be with us in terms of the content.
My guest today is Crystal Pite. She's the choreographer and founder of Kid Pivot. Kid Pivot presents the Tempest Replica, which continues tonight at the Helmreich Theater at Casha Hall, sponsored by Corgus Productions. Crystal Pite is created over 40 works for companies ranging from Netherlands Dance Theater to Ballet Frankfurt to the National Ballet of Canada, the Ballet Jazz de Montreal, and, of course, her own company, which she has been working with exclusively for the last several years. And the Tempest Replica was created in 2011 on the 400th anniversary of the Tempest, and they're currently on the final stages of a tour to tour this piece, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. earlier you were talking about how your choreographic style was influenced by the people you've worked with and your company itself. And I know you spent some time at Ballet Frankfurt with William Forsythe. The Tulsans have seen his work with Tulsa Ballet and are really loving that work. Can you give us a sense of how much comes from that experience as well as from your dancers yourself? It sounds like you're very influenced by your dance company itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's been just over 13 years since I left Frankfurt Ballet. I was there for 5 years as a dancer, and it was profoundly affecting and important to my growth, my development as a dance artist, as a dancer, but mostly as a creator, I think. I was so lucky to have the opportunity to be there, and the time working with Bill was so rich. I think some of the things that I've carried with me from that time are my willingness to take a risk. I think one of the things I loved about working with Forsythe was just to see him, to see his recklessness, to see him throw things away, to let things go and trust that another better idea was going to open up. To see him using improvisation in his work also, like to have that presence of risk and the unknown in the work, both in the process of generating it, but also in the performances themselves. I think that had a huge effect on how I thought about thinking things and also the question of performance.
I read an interview once where you said that you actually leave a lot of choreography in the studio.
You mean I make a lot of things that don't actually make it to the stage?
Exactly. Well, you do a lot of things that don't end up in the final product. Maybe that's the best way to put
it. I would say that's true of just about anybody who's making something. There's always things that you have to shed. But I think when I used to see Bill throw things away, we were always just in shock because, you know, these great structures that he would have been tinkering with for weeks, months, would just be left behind. And some other new crazy thing would come in to fill that void. And it was so, so exhilarating to see that, to be part of that. And I think, too, just at the heart of it, it's his sense of curiosity and delight that really caught me. And I think of him often when I make things, is that, you know, he's working in a state of terror. Like, he really did and does work with a degree of terror in him. Even after all this success and all these years of experience, he's still scared. And he shows up anyway. And he is a leader and a very inspiring force, even despite all that. So I hang on to that when I work. I think about how frightened he must have been at the front of the room, facing 40 dancers, all expecting him to know what to do. And you just don't know. We always thought he knew. Now, after all these years later, I realize he probably didn't know as much as we thought he knew. And he had to make it up as he went along, and he had to not know in front of all of us. And that's hard.
And act like he does.
and continue a forward motion and a momentum and an energy, which is also essential for his collaborators and his interpreters to move forward and to contribute.
Now
so
you're
a great balance. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Now, your company seems like a bit more modest. How many dancers are in Kid Pivot?
Well, right now there's just seven.
Seven. Is that actually more helpful or actually adds to that fear you're talking about when you're standing in front?
No, I love having a small group for my own company. And I have lots of opportunities to work with large groups when I go away and work with other companies. In the context of my own group, I like to keep it small. I like to keep it intimate. It's a good number. It's an amount of people you can fit comfortably around a dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conversation you can sustain between six people or seven people that doesn't easily break off into lots of smaller conversations. It's something we can share. So there's something really special about that for me. And I don't aspire to grow the company at all. I like to keep it to this small handful.
Well, from what I can see, you have some really, really fine dancers, too.
I do. They're just incredible. They amaze me every day. And I'm so fortunate to be working with them. And I'm so fortunate to have long-term relationships with these guys, because I think it's only through that that you can only really build the work. You can build the understanding and the trust and the history, and then you can go forward more beautifully, more potently. I think it's is essential. I mean, I've also had lots of experiences of working with dancers I've only just met, and that can be exciting too. And there's a great energy and the sense of discovery that comes with that. It's really, really motivating. But at the end of the day, it's my own company that I, that, you know, it's my baby. So I care about it a lot.
Kid Pivot presents The Temptress Replica, which continues tonight at the Helmrich Theater at Casha Hall. My guest today is the choreographer and founder, Crystal Pite, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I have one last question that has to do with, you're working with Shakespeare, beautiful language. Do you actually use his language as a part of the production? I know that I've read that the opening moment, Prospero actually offers a command to Ariel, you know, Ariel,
yeah,
come here. But,
yeah,
but is there actual language in the show?
There is.
Uh-huh.
So we use it in a couple of different ways. I'm projecting some of the text onto the backdrop. So in part one, where we're watching the replicas, we really see that each of the scenes is labeled,
mm-hmm,
the projected text. So you'll read Act 1, Scene 2, Prospero's daughter sees the shipwreck.
I see.
Later in the show, we return to that same scene where his daughter sees the shipwreck, but now there she is, flesh and blood, real person. She's dancing on the edge. She's destabilized. She's flailing. She's desperate. And you read the text on the backdrop now behind her, encapsulate that scene. It's an excerpt of the play that I chose to encapsulate it. Oh, I have suffered with those that I saw suffer, dashed all to pieces. Oh, the cry did knock against my very heart.
Hmm.
And so that text appears and disappears at a certain point in that scene and hopefully underlines the essential feeling of that moment. And I don't do that with every scene. I chose it carefully, and I don't use it a lot. But I felt like if there was a moment, for example, with Prospero and his duet with Caliban, the beginning of their connection starts with a text from the play where he says, "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine." And I felt like that line was so right for the piece, because it felt like it was Prospero acknowledging his own monster, the monster within him, as well as his relationship with this creature, this being. So, yeah, the text is there. You also hear it sometimes in the actual sound score. You'll hear a little whispered excerpt of text. You'll hear Ariel's voice whispering, "I boarded the king's ship, but on the beak, now in the waist, the deck, in every cabin I flamed amazement." You'll hear her whispering little shards of text. And I don't know if people can really hear it, but they get the sense of a presence, of something whispered, of something fluttering in the voice.
Hmm.
So hopefully it all adds up.
Well, we look forward to The Temptress Replica. Crystal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much as well.
Crystal Pite, the founder and choreographer for Kid Pivot, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Kid Pivot presents The Temptress Replica tonight at 8 o'clock at the Helmrich Theater at the Casha Hall Performing Arts Center, presented by Corgus Productions. Information at corgus.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. You can look for Studio Tulsa and look for our most recent programs or search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.